March 14th, 2005. We are still on the Department of Higher Education. And I'll open a public hearing on SB 5513. Mr. Chancellor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, George Pernsteiner. I'm the acting chancellor of the Oregon University System. I'm joined at the table this morning by Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services and President Dave Frohnmayer of the University of Oregon. Today, we're going to begin a discussion with you about what it is you buy when you invest in the Oregon University System and in its students and its faculty and its campuses. President Frohnmayer will speak more today about a return on investment that the University of Oregon brings to the state of Oregon and to this, basically to the state government as well. We also will have a discussion about not just what the return is, but how we determine whether or not we are on course to bring you that return, and a discussion of performance measures, both as they are used on the campus, President Dow will speak about that, and as we look at them from the point of view of the state system, which will be discussed by Susan Weeks, our planning officer. Before we get into that, I would call your attention again to our responses to day three questions, which dealt mostly with admissions of Oregon residents. About 88% of those who applied were admitted. The first-year retention rate for undergraduate students, which is about 80%, a little bit higher for resident than for non-resident students. The graduation rate, which is about 56% and roughly comparable to national numbers. And information about the undergraduate tuition exchange programs, WUE, Western Undergraduate Exchange. Last year we received 1,210 students from other states, and 1,510 Oregonians went to other states, and that's the current mix, if you will. And finally, there is a comparison of fee remissions of the comparator schools to the University of Oregon, Oregon State. Those are in your packet from this morning, and at that point, with the chair's indulgence, I'd like to turn it over to President Frohnmayer.
There would be one clarification, and you've given part of the answer here, but you gave an answer to the entire question that was asked last week. But I had a separate question I was going to ask, but didn't want to ask until I knew the answer. But I just wanted to get it on the record. For our institutions in higher education, for Oregon residents that meet the minimum qualifications, understand those are different GPA levels at different universities in the system. There may be some prerequisites in terms of the course structure that the person took in high school, but that if someone meets those minimum qualifications, you admit them.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. If an Oregonian meets the minimum qualifications set by an institution, the Oregonian is admitted.
Okay. I just wanted to get that on the record.
Yes, thank you.
And Mr. Frohnmayer, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dave Frohnmayer, President of the University of Oregon. My privilege here to testify to you today on return on investment. And I guess I'd like to ask the members of this committee to keep two general thoughts in mind as I proceed through a fair number of facts and figures. The first is to ask yourselves, what is it that we do as a legislative assembly? What enterprises do we fund or expenditures are we asked to make that have a larger quantifiable return on that investment than those about which I'm to testify? Now, there may be some. Clearly the state's Department of Revenue, and perhaps some would say the state lottery. But I would argue to you, and I think that the figures will be pretty persuasive to you, that it's very hard to think of any other expenditures of general fund dollars which are entrusted to your care that have such tangible returns, not only in terms of actual dollars, but in terms of human capital. And so if you will allow me at least to proceed through this to try to make a demonstration if I can. The state investment in dollars returns human capital as well as dollars. OUS universities, especially including the major research universities, bring in significant amounts of outside dollars, the vast majority of which, in the case of the University of Oregon, 87% of which is spent right here in the state of Oregon. The return on investment, conservatively estimated, from University of Oregon revenues from the general fund alone is 10 to 1. we also generate human capital, and we're filled with people who attract people, who attract businesses and other people with ideas. College graduates, as I think we all know, but it's worth reminding ourselves of these figures, have higher rates of income tax payments to the general fund because they have more earnings. They have a higher rate of volunteerism in terms of civic engagement. They have a higher rate of voting. They have lower rates of poverty, lower rates of unemployment, and lower rates of demand on state and community health services. Or said another way, in terms of those expenditures of the general fund, which require an outgo of general fund, this is a population, because of the level of educational attainment, which will be less of a drain on those resources. There is a correlation, it's now well documented in Oregon, and it's true nationwide and I believe worldwide. There's a correlation between higher levels of education and higher earnings for all racial and ethnic groups, and for both men and women. Right now, the income gap between a person who has a college, a high school diploma and a college degree is $1 million over a lifetime, and that gap is growing. So that says to us something very powerful about the ability of a person these days to attain that great goal and worthy goal, we hope, of American life, which is to attain status in the American middle class. Increasingly, overwhelmingly, I would argue to you, and I think the data bears us out, that it will increasingly be defined by level of educational attainment, which gives rise to this imperative that we give as many motivated young people the opportunity to attain the highest level of education that they possibly can during the course of their lifetime. This is clearly a worldwide phenomenon. I've seen it in other nations. I know that you've seen the data with respect to other nations. It's part of the emergence of the knowledge economy and the global competition with which we're confronted. If you earn more, you pay more in taxes. 1,000 more Oregonians earning a BA means $62 million more in state and local taxes paid over a lifetime, again helping to refurbish the somewhat scarce coffers of our government. In terms of the actual contributions now of dollars into the Oregon economy, I think by dimension, these figures are staggering compared to almost any other enterprise in which you invest general fund dollars. Sponsored research dollars last year in the state system were $250 million, $264 million to be exact. This is new money. This is money that without the university system would not be anywhere near the state of Oregon. These are high-wage jobs and high-multiplier jobs in terms of their impact throughout the economy. Non-resident tuition dollars are a separate source of money brought into Oregon, $116 million last year, more than a tenth of $1 billion. More than half of this, I should point out, is from the University of Oregon, about $60.2 million just last year. These are students who are attracted by the quality of education in this state. But conversely, if that quality is perceived to fall for reasons due to underfunding, that's a source of revenue that is quickly lost to us, and the spiral goes down quickly because this has now become such a significant part of my own university's income. Private dollars supporting the Oregon University system last year was $152 million, $92 million in gifts and pledges at the University of Oregon alone in response to our campaign. So that total, just for 1 year in this last biennial period, is $532 million, more than $500 million tangibly brought in from external sources. If that were brought in by the State Department of Economic Development, if that were brought in by any private entrepreneur, that would be regarded as an economic development triumph, to be trumpeted not merely in the region, but around the United States of America. $500 million, and this is happening every single year at this rate. I turn now to the University of Oregon, with which I'm obviously most familiar, to bring us down to the ground level. What's happening at one institution? Last year, we generated more than $430 million in revenues. This is cash. 14% of that came from the state. Or said another way, the state, in its budget, gave us a hunting license to find the other 86% of the revenues that it takes to drive our organization. We brought in, based upon that base investment, more in tuition than our state appropriation, more in grants and contracts than our state appropriation, and more in private gifts than our state appropriation. Our sponsored research was a record $90.2 million. That's a 56% increase in 3 years. That equates, and this is another way to look at it, at about $150,000 per faculty member. Or said another way, through the research enterprise of the University of Oregon alone, if our faculty were to do no other thing, they would more than pay for their salaries and OPE entirely from the overall aggregate of federal research grants. $22.7 million of this came to the University of Oregon's College of Education alone. That's $1.5 million per faculty member in federal grants. It is the most productive education faculty in the United States, attracts more federal research dollars than any other education faculty for the last seven out of the last 8 years. It's in the top five public colleges of education in the nation for the past 4 years, in the top 10 public or private colleges of education in the nation for 3 years in a row. The accolades go on. The point of this, though, is that that one particular area, carved out and refined and brought together in a highly effective working group, which has actually happened since ballot measure 5's cutbacks almost sliced it to the bone, is a tribute to and also an example of how quickly research dollars can have an impact not only on the reputation of a college, but also tangibly on the creation of jobs in this state alone. This is only one area in which my particular university excels, and each university can tell its own story, which we proudly would bring before you. Our other areas are nanoscience, about which we've testified previously, molecular biology, really for the last half century, neuroimaging, determining the most innermost secrets of the brain and mind, violence prevention in the schools. We turn now to private gifts. Last year was $93 million as part of our campaign, but the real story is that the larger campaign is for $600 million for student scholarships, endowment, building new residence halls and learning spaces, doubling our endowed faculty positions so that we don't have to worry as much as we do now, and we worry enormously about it, the problem of potential faculty flight due to the fact that our salaries are only at about 80% of those of our comparator institutions in the Association of American Universities. We've raised in this campaign more than $320 million in gifts and pledges. That includes over $11 million for the College of Education Building Project. A small footnote here, but a very big plea to this committee. 2 days from now, you will hear, as part of a capital construction budget, a plea for matching funding for the College of Education. We have $11 million, $10 million of which has come in a grant from a private foundation. Only a few days ago, I received from a member of the board of directors of that foundation, who is well acquainted with the excellence of the College of Education, the question as to why the state of Oregon or the president of the university has not been able to find the matching money, bonding, whatever, in order that that foundation's money would be securely invested in the enterprise for which we made the appeal for money. My concern is this, and I think the committee senses it, that we ask for private philanthropy to step forward, but the private philanthropists expect the state to do its part. This is a premier college of education, educating not only Oregonians and the teachers for the future, but also having a nationwide impact. And we are at the present time in the embarrassing position, at least from the standpoint of the president of the university, of not being able to tell a major donor that the university can follow through with its commitments if the private sector follows through with its commitments to us. I mentioned to you just a moment ago that we have tuition revenues in excess of the state appropriation to the university. But those students who come bring spending habits as well, which is an enormously lucrative enterprise for local industry. $140 million annually in non-resident spending. But putting that quite aside, and I hope that you would want me to put it aside, our most valuable gain is educated Oregonians ready to join our workforce at the highest levels. Why does it matter? Well, this committee knows why it matters. Oregonians are our greatest resource. Our niche in the global market depends upon these students remaining here and having the skills to engage right away in one of the most competitive economies in the history of the world. A single graduating class from the University of Oregon, just to scale it for you, will contribute $120 million in income taxes over its lifetime. Based solely upon value added by a four-year college degree, the state of Oregon taxpayers will give $1.60 in revenue for every dollar invested in them. Just to put that in perspective, that's 4.5 times greater than the average return on equities in the stock market over the last 50 years. Capital construction. Of course, this adds bricks and mortar. Of course, this adds spaces. Of course, it adds opportunity. But just again to give you a sense of the dimension of the state system of higher education and why the investment has such big payoff and why it's so important. More than half of all the buildings in the state that are state-owned are in the OUS system. So if you think about the stewardship of which this subcommittee is the primary initial overseer, the largest single investment in state plant and capital is in the Oregon University system, and it's more than half of all of the buildings. They have a current replacement value of $3.4 billion. Capital construction jobs create a huge new opportunity for citizens, especially when the economy is down. Approximately 9 new full-time jobs for every $1 million of project budget. More than 3,000 jobs will be created around the state from the funding of deferred maintenance alone and the capital construction projects that are proposed to you for all of this, all seven campuses. Again, turning from the general, which is enormous in its impact, to the University of Oregon, capital construction on our campus is more than a third of $1 billion since 1995. Only a tiny fraction of it has been in G-bonds. And yet, through that leveraged effort, we provided 4,122 direct and indirect jobs over the lives of these projects. Business development and technology transfer, yet another arena of return on investment. And again, gentlemen and ladies of the committee, we have tried to be as precise as we can in estimating these so that you actually have quantifiable numbers before you. And this is yet another category. Technology transfer, nearly $2 million in licensing income in the year 2003-2004. 40 new inventions last year, new inventions that can receive the category of intellectual property, patent, trademark, major recognition by the United States government. 18 startup or spin-off companies, 3 last year alone. Sometimes these go on to form other companies and other startups. One of them is called Cerebral Data Systems. It's a brand new company that's in the process of spinning out from another company that was founded by University of Oregon people called Electrical Geodesics and the University of Oregon's Neuroinformatics Center. Big words, but they actually have a recent impact that you may have seen on the newsstand. This latest issue of the National Geographic magazine shows a wonderful person meditating while his brain is being examined by an invention that is fundamentally like that patented from the University of Oregon. And this is a way of measuring this gentleman's brain waves to determine how consciousness is or may be altered, how people process information in terms of the physiology of the electrochemical contacts that are made, which has important implications not merely for understanding the human mind in this vast mystery that it has been, but also in dealing with learning disabilities, in identifying ways in which people actually learn differently, in finding healthcare solutions to stroke, which is one of the most debilitating and expensive impacts on our entire Medicare, Medicaid, Oregon health plan budget. All of these are things that basic research has to do in a practical sense in terms of its impacts on human health and human life. We estimate, not we personally, the United States Department of Commerce estimates that 40 jobs are supported for every $1 million in research. Based upon our fiscal 2004 research alone, that equates to 3,400 jobs at the University of Oregon. So to recapitulate, if I may, over half $1 billion have come to this state from outside sources alone in the last year. $90 million of that for sponsored research at the university, $93 million in private gifts, $200 million in non-resident tuition and spending at the university. Our capital projects, by conservative estimate, by estimates that we can verify, are 4,122 jobs from the capital investment projects since 1995. The state's economy receives $10 for every single dollar of investment at the university. We have from this investment massive business innovation and technology transfer at the very cutting edge of human discovery and at the very cutting edge of the development of new corporations that have high-wage jobs that stay right here in the state of Oregon. So degrees conferred equate to brain power. They equate to investing in our Oregonians. They equate, in essence, to our future. An investment in Oregon university system is, in fact, an investment in Oregon's economy, investment in its future, and one which, if it were in the private sector, you'd want to buy shares, because the return on that investment over time is simply staggering in its positive benefit. I can think of other investments that you make. Maybe an investment in the Department of Revenue, but that revenue basically comes from Oregonians and is simply redistributed to the taxation system. You might say lottery, but the lottery, to the extent that you support it at all, simply again takes from Oregonians and reinvests in other Oregonians. This investment invests not only in Oregonians, but it brings in massive sources, more than $500 million a year, from sources external to the state of Oregon and enriches our lives. We hope that you'll believe that that is a challenge and that is an investment that is worth enhancing because of its value to the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Barmeyer?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, President Barmeyer, for testifying. And you see, the thing I'm struggling with is this whole thing is what comes first in this thing. Is it opportunities for Oregon or is it education for Oregon? Jeffrey Tyrens and the Progress Board has their circle of prosperity. But we looked at that earlier, and basically the circle of prosperity in Oregon is, according to that schematic, is broken because we don't have the funds to properly invest. I mean, I think that's everybody's pretty much aware of that, that we could be investing more money in several areas in education. And then below the circle or before this investing in education is, in his list, is opportunities for all Oregon. It seems to me that it ought to be switched around. But from your testimony, you're saying, well, you know, you got to invest in education. And how do you create the opportunities for Oregon? I mean, I'm really struggling with this. How do we justify the investment in education when people don't have opportunities? I mean, there's only 25% of the people will go to higher university. What do we do with the other 75% of the folks?
I've tried, Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, I've tried to demonstrate to the extent aggregate figures can do this that there is, in essence, a higher education pull on the economy. This is not wage push, it's education pull. And that, in fact, the effect to which you've referred, Senator Nelson, is precisely the effect that you achieve in a magnified way from the, if I may say, fairly modest dollars that have been invested in higher education. This enterprise, only 14% of which at the University of Oregon receives any state dollars. That's the total state contribution to the present University of Oregon budget. Has the capacity through its dynamism and through the leverage effect to generate money from out of state that comes in to educate Oregonians. And I guess that's the key. The surprise is that with a declining amount of state appropriation, we have been able to increase state federal research dollars. We've been able to hold level or increase out-of-state tuition, which in turn pays for the education of Oregonians. So actually, what you invest is leveraged dollars. There are almost no state dollars in research. So we have to find the startup money from that from other sources, but that in turn has a ripple effect to provide jobs for Oregonians, provide construction money for Oregonians, provide research grants for Oregonians, and opportunity for kids.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, in addition, I'm reminded of the discussion that the Vice President of Intel had at the Business Summit last December, in which he talked about the need for a highly educated workforce in Oregon, and that there were two ways that that could occur in order to spur the prosperity. And one was that we could import that workforce, and the other is that we could educate Oregonians to be that workforce. And I think his point in that, and part of the OBC message of that day, is that if we are to provide opportunity throughout the state of Oregon. We have to provide education throughout the state of Oregon, and in so doing, we will create the workforce that, in fact, the industries are looking for as they expand or as they locate. And so, in addition to everything that President Frohnmayer said, I would emphasize the need then for an educated workforce in order to have that circle of prosperity that you're talking about.
Senator Nelson, do you have a follow-up?
On page 8, you talked about the state economy receives $10 for every $1 of investment. And prior to that, you talked on page 5 that taxpayers receive $1.60 in tax revenue for every dollar. And I was just trying to differentiate between how the economy, I guess you're talking about tax revenues in this instance and economy in this instance. So there is a difference there. So. We've heard from other agencies about there's return on investment. Wasn't Oregon Health Science University 27-1 or something like that? I'm wondering, how do you get to these figures? I mean, how can we actually quantify it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, the 10-1 figure is actually a well-documented economic study by Larry Singel of the Department of Economics of the University of Oregon. It's one which would be subject to peer review and which economists would verify based on the return on investment in the local area, Eugene Springfield, over last year or the year before. I've forgotten which one. I think it's the year before. But he is a certified good economist of national stature, and I think the multipliers that he used are also conservative.
Thank you.
Competent and good are probably different. Economist and good never seems to. Senator Gordley has
Thank
a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to pick up on Senator Nelson's comments about the broken circle of prosperity. And I'm wondering, I guess I'm listening for an admonition, and more of an admonition and a challenge that I don't hear coming forward, frankly. We all know that our tax code is broken, that our tax structure, our way of collecting revenue is broken. Would you agree?
I do. Retaining my right of free speech as a private citizen, at least, yes, Senator.
And that's what I want to draw on this morning. Would you please speak to us frankly and from your heart and head as an Oregonian, looking at what it is we need to do now and differently if we are to capture the kind of investment that you're talking about in not only higher education, I'm going to add pre-K through higher ed, our entire educational system. Our circle of prosperity is broken. It needs to be fixed. But we seem to be working with a group of electeds currently who seem incapable of meeting the challenge. Speak to me, please.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, I can speak to you within the confines of the governor's budget only in any official sense, and that is defined the revenues available and the expenditures as allocated. And that is my role officially. I can tell you, as a person who sits as a trustee of one of the largest foundations in Oregon, the major function of which is to ensure college scholarships for first-time families and needy students, that the need is just enormous, and that we have only the capacity to meeting a portion of that need, and that one of the things that makes your heart sick is to see the kids who aren't aspiring to college at all, who don't see that in their future because that hasn't been the way they grew up, or because they haven't been given a role model, or because they live in a place where that simply has never been a community expectation. And I think in that respect, Senator Nelson knows well the challenges faced by my colleague, who's the president of Eastern Oregon University, who was just invested this last weekend. When in Eastern Oregon, the 10 counties east of the mountains, there's a 10% lower rate of participation in higher education. And how are these kids going to deal with the remainder of this century? when we're told by an educator from Finland that they're trying to raise the level of college-educated percentage of their population from 50% to 75% over the next few years, and we are at 25% in the state of Oregon right now, as Senator Nelson properly recognized. Well, we do know that 61% of Oregonians who graduate from high school go on to some form of post-secondary education. They don't graduate yet, so they're getting it. We know that from the Progress Board surveys that a vast majority of Oregonians of all political parties, all stripes, wherever they live, recognize that if you do not have a college degree or close to it, over the next 10 years, your family income is going to decline. So we get it. We get it as a group of voters, and this is more than two-thirds of the people in the Oregon Values Survey responded that way. This is not a partisan issue. This is a worldwide survival issue. And that is, Senator Gordon, from my heart. The problem is, though, that of the 61% of Oregon high school graduates who go on to some form of post-secondary education, that's only the kids who are left in high school by the time they're seniors. And we're seeing a third of them drop out between the 9th and 12th grades, maybe as many as that in some areas of the state. That's a tragedy waiting to happen. It's a tragedy that's already occurred. Those kids, and they're still kids, are going to get pregnant too early. They're going to go on unemployment too early. They're going to go on welfare too early. They're going to commit crimes too early. They're going to be incarcerated at about $35,000 to $40,000 a year by budgets that you pay for per year. That's what's happening to them. So we break the circle, I think, to the educational process, because that, to me, is the easiest way to attack it, to get them to aspire to something, to support them so that they can get to have that level of educational attainment. And I have enough faith in them that as soon as they get that start, they'll take care of themselves.
Well, I appreciate where your faith is placed in them.
Well, our responsibility is to give them their chance.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'll leave it here.
Senator Whitfield.
Chair Devlin,
Mr. President. First, a comment. We hear a lot that investment, capital, construction, jobs will create jobs and kickstart the economy, and it will. But it's a kickstart. It, for the most part, those construction jobs are financed with borrowed money, and so the money that has to be paid back, and so that in my mind, for that to be a very good investment, you have to be able to develop industry sufficient to employ your graduates in order to create the revenues to pay that back plus a profit, and then it makes it a good investment. But to me, it's a little off the mark to say that it's a good thing for our economy it is on the short term, but it's only a good thing in the long term if we invest it in the proper way to get a return on that investment so we can pay it back. I think also that we must prepare our graduates for the industry sector in which they're educated, and so they're prepared to go to work when they come out of college. And I wonder, do you have any figures on the University of Oregon and the Oregon University system on what percentage of your graduates are, say, within 6 months employed within the sector that they were educated for, or are enrolled in a master's or PhD program?
Those are available.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, in the benchmarks presentation, the performance measures presentation that will follow this, that's one of the things that is looked at. So you'll see those data.
That is within sector?
No, we don't do it within sector because we don't collect the information that way. We do it in the aggregate. Part of the question is, what is the sector for many of the degrees that we offer? In some cases, it's clear. In other cases, it's not. And one of the things that came home to me, and I think it was in the testimony of Kirby Dias, who's here again today, is that with ETIC funds, we thought originally what we were doing was trying to create engineers for the high-tech sector. It turns out we're creating engineers for the entire economy, because those people are going to work in every kind of business in Oregon because we're having such a technological change. So I think it's very difficult then to do a one-to-one track to what type of degree do you have and what kind of industry do you go to. Instead, we do an aggregate count of, are you employed
within the state of Oregon.
What comes to mind there is, if I may, my second daughter graduated from Oregon State in marine biology, good grade point average sort of thing. And then she went to work for Frank Morris dispatching concrete trucks. And she has a good job, and she enjoyed working for Senator Morris. But it really was not what she was prepared for. She was employed, but she wasn't employed in the sector which she was prepared for. And, I think whether you're going to engineering, whether you go into engineering and agriculture or in forestry or wherever, you're still in engineering.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, I guess I'm prepared to make a more daring point, although I don't know that daring is the right word. 70% of the jobs that people now do today did not exist in the occupational categories of the U.S. Department of Labor in 1940, the year I was born. We can, I think, pretty confidently expect that our students will probably have 5 to 6 jobs, occupations, professions during the course of their lifetime, and maybe as many as 3 or 4 of them haven't been invented yet. And what that suggests to us by way of educational strategy is that they have to have the foundational skills of learning how to learn through the course of a lifetime that will give them the capacity to survive and adapt to jobs, occupations, professions, the contours of which we don't even understand. It's hard for us to remember that the personal computer, for example, didn't even come on the market until the year 1982. And they didn't become widely available to about 1984. And it's so much a part of our life that we can't imagine a job or profession without it. So we are placing our bets, and I think wisely so, and I don't know a university world that's not, is placing the bets on giving the fundamental capacity to learn how to learn through skills of collaborative learning, through manipulation of language and numbers, through the skill of mastering a particular discipline that will give students the ability to survive in that very turbulent world. And without knowing either your daughter or the place in which she was trained, I do know something about the discipline of marine biology, and I believe that the kinds of skills that your daughter gained there made her far better as an employee for Senator Morris than she otherwise would have been, and has in fact given her a set of lifetime survival skills that will keep her in good stead no matter where she goes. Had she gone in from high school to that same job, my guess would be that even as talented as I know she would be, that it would be a much, much more difficult role for her to hoe. And that's what we think is the value added of the collegiate education, of the baccalaureate degree. That's where we placed our bets as a civilization, and that's where every country in the world is placing them as well. It's perhaps the best I can do at the moment, but I think that I'm prepared to make that conversation with you in private in much greater degree, and I think we'd be persuaded.
Representative Jensen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, President Frohmeyer, for your presentation. I'm always impressed with your presentations. I think because I've borrowed heavily from you in my political campaigns that I've had over the years, not I think because you have necessarily educated me with the speeches and presentations that you've made, but because you have the great and infinite wisdom to talk about the things that I agree with. might I add, to say them perhaps much more eloquently than I can. I do understand and appreciate, and this has been a theme song of mine for the time that I've spent in the legislature, and I truly hope that it remains my theme song, although I would like to think that we could somehow or another do something in the course of my legislative career that would make that unnecessary. I don't know that that's going to be forthcoming in this session, however. One of the things that has sometimes concerned me about higher education, university education in the state of Oregon is what I have sometimes perceived to be an overemphasis on undergraduate education at the cost and expense of graduate education. And I note in your presentation this morning and previous times that the value that is added to our university system and to the economy of the state through the research grants that take place or that come about because of the universities. And I think most of those grants come about because of the graduate education we have and the quality of that graduate education. I don't mean to downplay the significance of having good undergraduate programs there either, because they feed the graduate programs, and you know, obviously, in some ways. Is that I'm unable to detect a trend here right now with your presentation, but is that emphasis still kind of where the university is going to put those graduate programs as somewhat subservient to the undergraduate education?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Jensen, I hope not, but I hope also that in my presentation to you I pointed out that the value added comes across multiple contributions of the state system, that the value added in terms of the individual's life and livelihood comes pretty demonstrably from that first 4 years between high school and the baccalaureate degree. And, of course, there's value added for each stage of the graduate program. But in terms of what comes back to the state, what comes back to the individuals who are helped, it's very directly associated in that sense, in that capacity, with undergraduate education. The graduate and professional education contributes to the economy and contributes to the well-being of Oregonians in other tangible ways. And the curiosity is, of course, that there's almost no state investment in our graduate programs. The state investment comes almost entirely at the undergraduate level. The amount given to research in our budget, as you know, is very modest. It's really used just for startup costs and for giving us the capacity to go after federal grants. Does that help the state? Actually, fairly directly, and I think Representative Jensen, you know that very well because of the contributions of our sister university, Oregon State University, to the development of strains of wheat which are resistant to particular forms of fungus or rot that might otherwise have devastated the Oregon wheat crop in years past. That's value added by Oregon State University to this state, measured in the tens of millions of dollars, and certainly in the Eastern Oregon economy very directly. So I'm not going to make my case for higher education at the expense of any sector of our education, because the value added is tangible, and it can be measured in tens, hundreds of millions of dollars in many cases, both in undergraduate and in graduate education. Now, I hope that's responsive to your question, and if it's not, I apologize.
I think it is, but I think it also is somewhat emphasizing the truth of my concern that there's no state dollars go into graduate education, that those are all exterior to the state, which is therefore something of a lack of investment on the part of the state. And I do appreciate that the research needs to have exterior dollars, funding sources, whether that be the federal government or whether it be the private sector, and I realize it comes, you know, from both. But I worry that we don't make a better contribution, I guess, and I, along with everybody else on this committee, understand the problems that we're facing right now. And you will appreciate, Mr. Chair, that this is an editorial note more than anything else, and I thank you for your indulgence. And I thank President Frohmeyer for his presentation here this morning.
Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Nelson has a follow-up.
This discussion sort of struck some things with me. If we're not able to fix our tax system, if it is broken, if we're not able to fix it, what are the solutions? And if you look around at other states, there are actually still 12 states in the United States that have a surplus, even in these terrible, terrible, terrible economic times. To me, I'm not sure that the university or higher education system is actually taking the lead and saying there are other solutions out here also.
And I'm advocating that not only with you folks, but K through 12, there are other solutions out there, but we need people at the community level, at the university level, or at the K through 12 level to come up and say, okay, this is how we can solve this problem. You know, if we can solve it with tax reform, that would be fine, but I'm not so sure we can do that with the taxpayer. So is there another solution there? What are the other states doing? Maybe we ought to go back to gambling. Maybe that's the way we can solve it. I mean, Nevada does that. So to me, I'm advocating that people that are coming in asking the legislature for money also have an obligation to go out and say, okay, there are other solutions out here. We're going to take the lead. We're going to push these things, educate people, the public in general, not just their students, educate the people in general that this is how we can solve this problem. And what is and going back to something Intel, one of the Intel folks told me, is focus on what you do well. Yeah. And I don't think we're getting that message out.
Did you want to respond?
Well, I could, but I'm acutely aware that I'm trespassing on the time of all those who've been carefully signed up and have been allotted far more time because they have an even bigger message than I do. I think we followed all of the strategies that one could follow, including growing the pie, which is partly why we emphasize the creation of high-wage, high-productivity, high-leverage jobs that come from the research enterprise itself and that come in a magnificent way from that enterprise. Beyond that, the strategy, I think, are pretty obvious. You cut costs where you can cut them. We've done that since Measure 5 fairly dramatically. Statistically, we don't get more state dollars in absolute terms from this legislative assembly than we got back in about 1989. Notwithstanding enrollment increases. So we're operating more efficiently on reduced dollars. We've increased revenue sources, which are primarily students and non-resident students, and that's been dramatic to the point where we have to address that issue as having probably run its limits in terms of double digits. We've increased our capacity to raise revenue from the federal government through research and other expenditures. And we've increased productivity. So all the obvious internal strategies, I think we followed slavishly and actually inventively, but there comes a time when you've run your string and when you do look for the expansion of the total revenue available to the state to make investments that have a tangible, identifiable return on the investment. And that's, I think, where we are today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, but on a different area. One of the items that I know that will be up for discussion, I just have a feeling that it will be up for discussion later in Phase 2. I personally don't have a concern about lifting remissions for graduate students. Also, I do have some faith in the system about lifting remissions for undergraduates. But I know it's been an issue in this discussions before. I know it's now capped at 8. I know that the proposal, I believe, is to go to 12 and then to lift the cap.
Cap.
Where do you ultimately believe would be an acceptable level for remissions? And how, knowing how this discussion is probably going to go later in this process, if we were to gradually move up the cap and leave the issue of lifting it until the next biennium, where would you lift it to?
May I defer to my colleague, the Chancellor, please?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. As you'll see on, I think it's the last page of the attachment from this morning, the average remissions of the comparator universities to Oregon and Oregon State is about 17%. We don't believe that we will ever... Well, I won't say never. We have never been in that range as a system, and consequently, we anticipate that the 10% in the 05-07 biennium would be sufficient at the undergraduate level. My guess is that over time, as we try to create the kinds of opportunities for students that we all have talked about before, that number may raise slightly from that to maybe as much as 12. That's as much as we have ever talked about, I think, among the presidents. But in fact, to have the flexibility would be very desirable. Some of the campuses, because of their programs and because of the types of students which they attract or wish to attract, run higher than that and some lower. OIT, for example, is well into the double digits now, but that's counterbalanced by a PSU that's much lower. So if we can hit a system-wide average of 10 in the next biennium, it may migrate slightly from that in the future, but I don't anticipate it will change very much.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. If I may add just a quick footnote. One is that I do hope that you give sufficient attention to the different circumstances of different campuses and not try to legislate an overall uniform remission. The second is a plea, and it's really a sincere plea. We are obligated by law to have balanced budgets on individual campuses as well as system-wide. We depend enormously on tuition revenue now because of the actions of this legislative assembly. We have no fiscal interest in going broke. So why is it that we're not given some degree of discretion in deciding where the break-in even point is, where the incentives balance the disincentives of losing revenue, where the attractions of getting students or giving opportunity to a kid who's never been to college and whose family can't afford it and they can't get scholarships? Why can't we be given some degree of discretion determining ourselves, since we do have the obligation to maintain a balanced budget, to finding that level for ourselves? We don't have any interest in going broke or losing revenues beyond those that we think are good incentives.
I can understand that sentiment, President Frohmeyer. At the same time, going away from the issue of remissions, and I know that there's also been discussions about this before, you understand why the legislature has never entirely surrendered the issue of tuition increases to the system. I mean, we have students' associations and others that come in constantly when there's any proposal like that and argue against it. It's probably not looking for a response, but...
I can give one. Which is, if I may,
yes.
Senator, we don't have any interest in seeing tuition go up a single fraction of a percentage. If the state's general fund support of that tuition buy-down is dollar for dollar available. The reason that tuition has risen is not because our costs have risen. Our costs of educating undergraduate students at the University of Oregon are remarkably stable. The reason that tuition has increased is the withdrawal of general fund support for other university operations. That's a sad, unhappy truth that's a function of economic times and competing priorities.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Frohmeyer. Mr. Pernsteiner, we are a little bit behind, but we'll try to get back on the schedule. And keep in mind that we might have up to about if we need it, we might have up to about an hour on Thursday if we need to go over. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair, very much. As President Frohmeyer talked about some of the returns on investment you get, one of the things that we do, though, is to track whether or not we're making progress towards reaching the I think, fundamental benchmark of whether or not we're successful, which is the number of degrees produced in any given year or are we in a given period of time. And each campus takes a look at various performance indicators that show to it how well it is doing in meeting some of the fundamental goals, which we'll talk about later today and tomorrow. Martha Ann Dow, president of OIT, is here to talk about how performance measures are used on her campus to help manage.
Thank you, members of the committee and Chair Devlin. It's a pleasure to be able to present to you the beginning, I think, of what will be an interesting discussion on accountability through the performance indicators. And my role is really to set the stage. I almost said set it up, but it's set the stage for Susan Weeks to continue at a more global, comprehensive level. But I think where the Oregon University System performance indicators are important to us on individual campuses is through our ability to focus in on our own unique missions and do strategic planning in order to fulfill our goals and our outcomes and assess that in a way that interrelates with not only the system performance indicators, but also our own individual plan for success. And I think no matter which campus you look at, we spend a significant amount of dedicated time in setting our foot forward and being able to say that our ultimate goal is the success of our students, and how are we going to manage that. So goals and outcomes and assessment become a key part of not only how we relate to the performance indicators, but how we do measure our activities and our success, and we are accountable to all our stakeholders. You, our students, our industries, our economy of Oregon, and particularly the students. So our particular strategic planning process, our plan right now between 2002 and 2007, a five-year plan, is called Blueprint for Success. And the focus of that is to take ourselves from where we are to fulfill our own unique mission to deliver baccalaureate and master's degree programs in technology education throughout the state, and in fact throughout the Pacific Northwest, because we have a very unique niche in that area. We can connect the performance indicators then with our campus strategic plan and also with our accreditation requirements. We not only have to fulfill assessment with regional accreditation performance indicators, but also for those of us who have professional programs that involve registries and other kinds of professional accreditation, must fulfill those. So if I look at particularly now OIT's strategic plan, our strategic plan includes the major goals of access and affordability and quality and partnerships and efficiencies and the success, of course, of our students, and also how we play into the civic contributions within this strategic plan for our students. We look at ourselves comparatively, too, with our peers, and through the performance indicators, we all have peer institutions as similar as we can get them to our own missions. In OIT's case, this is somewhat difficult to have a full set of comprehensive peers. So we look at them programmatically, because our primary mission in terms of programs is either in engineering technology, or the health technologies and management. So we try to contrast how we're doing and benchmark with those peers. And as we look at this over the last few years in assessment with our peers and with OUS, we have a motto that says, prepare yourself for a world of change. And that is how we're looking at our strategic directions. The evolution of the technologies and the connections that we need to make sure that we'll fulfill our mission. We do say then that our performance indicators will show to you a return on the investment with what we can provide for those students. So we have learning outcomes that engage us in looking at how do we know we're doing the best for our graduates. What must our graduates know? What must they be able to do? And what characteristics do they need to be successful? And all of these areas are woven into outcomes and ways to measure that. For example, if I took our health professions programs, we look at their scores on their post-registration exams. We look at their evaluations from their internships, or we call them externship placements with the medical industry, and we look at how well they get the jobs in those particular professional areas when they graduate. As we look at these ways to evaluate that, we of course ask our own students, how do you know you're effective out there? What is it OIT needs to do differently in providing you that kind of education that you can go out and be a true professional in your area? Of course, we're looking at programs in engineering as well that are ABET accredited. We need to meet certain assessment outcomes. And as we do our core performance indicators that are part of all of our indicators, such as retention, time to graduation, number of graduates, employability, we also set targets that speak to our own heart and desire to succeed in certain areas. For us, women in engineering is a key strategic goal. And when I put this data up, I could be doing it at great peril, right? Because you can see, obviously, that I have a declining enrollment in women engineering. But that is something we want to do better at. So we're not weak-kneed when it comes to setting our specific campus performance indicators. We want to go for what we think fully would allow us to achieve a mission. So inside that strategic plan right now for OIT, there's a major focus that will foster those goals for us for targets in women in engineering. And we're not alone. This is a national trend. But we would like to be a pilot for how you can turn some of that around. So we are aligning that with many pre-college programs, with other partners, with our school system, with our local community college. How do we incent young women and prepare them in the math and science that they need to be successful? How do we create the environment internally that continues to give them the progress and the opportunity they need? And we will meet our target. We've had to reset it because we have a ways to go back up. But we are going to make it. And as a personal achievement for me, a woman that comes from science curricula, it will be an awful setback if I cannot achieve that goal for Oregon Institute of Technology. So all of us, in our own way, and performance indicators, have to have a passion for reaching those goals and for being accountable. And I know that each year, as we look at our targets and reset them, we will find that sometimes we're going great guns and sometimes we're not.
We Senator have a question from Representative Jensen.
Excuse me.
I appreciate your concern in relationship to the declining women in engineering at OIT. However, I have a concern with the data and to its relative significance. I'd like to see a longer period of time there before I would want to be too critical of what has happened at your institution.
I think that Representative Jensen and Chairman Devlin, I think that's a good question because all of these are based on trend lines. You know, we look at trends over a period of time and we then try to assess what is the causal relationship of some of those trends. And we do various techniques to do that, to get measurements. We look at national data and compare benchmarks there. We also look at our internal environment. Is there something changing there? So I agree with you that the targets in many times are somewhat superficial, but yet a good indicator of something we need to be very careful to look at.
Just a short follow-up,
yes.
Mayor, just a comment on that. I appreciate, you know, that concern, and I appreciate when you have data like this that it should, you know, raise a flag for one to begin to look further at it. I just hesitate at looking for any cause and effect relationship, you know, from this.
Right.
So, thank you.
I think the main thing is we want to do better, no matter where that line comes. Thank you. Another indicator for us, of course, is our graduate success. That is a measure of quality to us as well because when our graduates are hired and go out in their professional areas, we also look at the satisfaction of the employer and that data and how that relates to how we can contribute in a different way. As we look at our employability of our recent graduates, and this particular chart actually shows the percent of our students that are employed in their own fields, professional fields. And over the last few years, of course, we look at this, too, looks like we've gone from maybe a high of a 98% employability by that criteria to a 93%, kind of a flat line. And then we look at what does that mean from the standpoint of the high-tech industry, for example, some of the economic recession over those years that you see there, and also what is happening to those students. One interesting thing you can also see is that more of them are choosing to go on to grad school. And we're quite pleased with that. We have several engineering programs as well as programs in the health sciences where the students are leaving and going immediately into a graduate program. And that definitely is success. We have some of them now that are actually in med school that came out of our bachelor's in health sciences. We have a student that was just accepted this fall into Oregon Health Science University Dental School, and she came out of our health science and dental hygiene program. So those are still good statistics for us to have, and we're always interested in the employer satisfaction. We do that kind of study by looking at surveys that the employers do, that the students do, that the externship site clinical supervisors do for us, and also our alumni connections. Every one of our programs has an advisory board, many of which are alums on there employed in the industries that we are wanting to know data from. And we assess how work-ready were our graduates. For example, the civil engineering department does this routinely and asks its questions to the employer as, what is our student's ability to apply their math and their science concepts on the job, the ability to analyze and interpret data, to identify and formulate and solve problems, what is their ethical and professional standards, their communication skills, their use of current civil engineering design software, and so on, and their ability to work in teams. And these are the kinds of questions and evaluations we do on all of our students as they go out from the employer. We have corrections that we make from that, and in some instances, one of the corrections recently was our students do need more team time. We have senior projects that go on a whole year, but they need to learn to work more efficiently in a team. That's hard when you have highly competitive students that come out of educational systems that are highly individualized. But working in a team is a key performance indicator for the success of our graduates, and we find ways to track that. Currently, we know that this last year, 91% of them were still employed in their career-related position with an overall starting salary of $45,400. And, of course, that's impacted by the situation in the economy, but it's also a statistic and a performance indicator that we want to measure. President Frohmeyer has talked about the economic impact of these areas in education. And I would say in our performance indicators, we track what is it we're doing for our community and our state that relate to the economic impact. Of course, the students being educated in the professional disciplines that are needed are critical. And right now, I would say to you that OIT was very pleased to be able to participate in the ETIC particular area because that was to double the number of engineering graduates. And we're very proud that we were meeting goals there. I would recommend another one to you today, and that is the healthcare industry for being able to impact the economic issues driven by health-related jobs. That would be another one that would be key in the, as an economic driver. Also, business cluster development. In the rural part of Oregon, I think it's particularly important that these programs and these students can help develop business clusters for their communities. In OIT and Klamath Basin, of course, we have been able to attract DSI and some other industries now that are critical for our economy in that basin. And it's critical for those employers to have skilled and educated workforce. And many of our students would like to stay in rural Oregon. And this makes a huge difference. Of course, the salaries and the tax base that those employed graduates bring is also key. So, the ultimate goal for every one of our campuses is student success, and that's the ultimate performance indicator. And I would say to you that although sometimes you might think performance indicators are drudgery, they become exciting around the success and accountability of the students and keep us on track. And I thank you very much for this opportunity.
President Dow, thank you very much for your participation and your presentation. You indicated that one of the learnings around the performance indicators is that students need more time in teams. I'm also wondering what are we learning about the ethical standards of our students? What are we learning in that arena?
Senator Gordley and members of the committee, OIT has recently been quite concerned about that because in the professional disciplines that we educate students in, primarily health as well as engineering, I think it's very vital that the ethical standards are there and that we are literally educating them about what that means. What do we define when we say ethics? In our general education program, for example, all of them are required to take those ethics courses, and they are woven throughout the professional courses in the curriculum. We have many seminars around the discussion of professional ethics. And yet, Senator Gordley, I would have to admit that as far as having a global sense of that, I do not. But I know that we are very aware that that is very important.
It would be helpful if we could at some point get a handle on what are the challenges out there in the educational
right.
climate these days around ethical standards
yes.
and helping our students understand
exactly.
What is required mm-hmm. and what is appropriate. Are there other comments or questions for President Dow? Senator Whitsitt, good morning.
Good morning, Senator. President Dow, first I want to compliment you. I think you do customer service better than anybody else in the country does, both from the standpoint of students and their employers. I congratulate you on that effort. And I wondered if you would develop a little more the need for the medical technology, specifically the number of roughly the number of applicants, the number of seats that you have, and the number of applications for prepared employees that you have.
Thank you, Senator Whitsitt, Senator Gordley. Presently at OIT, in our medical programs, which include medical imaging and dental hygiene, nuclear medicine, radiology, sonography, all of those, we are out of capacity. This fall, we turned away around 300 qualified applicants, and the workforce needs out there are extreme. We are currently wanting to make sure that we're tuning up the workforce data in Oregon in all of the, particularly the allied health areas, and nursing data is also very obvious. And we are working together with the Hospital Association and the Community College Healthcare Action Group and others and within our Committee on Academic Excellence and Economic Development under the board chaired by Kirby Diaz. We are looking at all those workforce needs very specifically. And we'll come together, I think, with a plan about how to do this in partnership, not only OIT, but the community colleges and others that are engaged in the health professions. But I think, as we set our own strategic goals at OIT, we look at that workforce data, and we try to make sure that we are creating and expanding the capacity to provide access to the kinds of programs that are going to be critical in the medical industry in Oregon. And we have a lot more to do. This last year we expanded in our dental hygiene program. We actually have a partnership in Eastern Oregon now also to deliver dental hygiene there. And we think the key is partnerships in Oregon for this area. But OIT can very much take a lead in the baccalaureate level of those programs, and we wish to do so with our partners.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I note in your presentation you talk about learning outcomes and give some examples, one of which is registration exams.
Mm-hmm.
In your performance indicators, I didn't see any, didn't hear any.
We are.
Representative,
I didn't put specific numbers in there. We look at each of our professional programs on an annual basis. They will be taking the exam this spring following graduation or early June. And we have been running 100% pass rates on our dental hygiene registry exam and also in our imaging exams. Our engineering students take the fundamentals of engineering registry exam. We have only one, I would say, true engineering program. It's civil engineering. The others are engineering technology. And for the civil engineering fundamentals exam, excuse me, I think we have a pass rate right now of about 85%. We're working on that one. And in the engineering technology, for that exam, they have to have a year or two of experience before they take it.
Just a quick follow on that. Do you track that after, or are you able to track it after they've had that year or two of experience?
We are just starting to do that, Representative Jensen. Go back and make sure that we have collated all that data.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just say that I think would be helpful to us when we start looking at performance measures if we have that. And I don't mean this in any way as a criticism. I hope you understand.
No.
Have extremely high regards for OIT, having had some familiarity over the years with students going there from where I was at. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again, President Dow.
Thank you very much.
Senator Gourley, we now will turn this over to a discussion directly of performance measures. And it will be brought to you by Neil Bryant, who is a member of the Oregon Progress Board, which is the group that, in fact, the state has invested with that responsibility, and Susan Weeks, who is our deputy for planning. So Neil's not here.
Not
I think he's
chair.
Out with the chair.
Yes,
so.
He is.
Thank you, George. Madam Chair and members of the committee, well, I'll wait. I'll pause for a moment.
He's right behind you.
Good morning. My name is Neil Bryant. I'm an attorney from Bend and a consultant for the system, and I have a good excuse for being late. I was out in the hall with the chair. So,
it's not necessarily good for all.
I have the privilege of serving on the Oregon Progress Board. I've been on that board for 4 years. And I'm going to give a brief overview dealing with how we approach performance measures from a state level, a little bit on the national level, and then Susan will go into the details that I'm sure you'll find much more interesting. But the Oregon Progress Board was started in 1989 and did Oregon Shines in 1993, and there are 90 indicators. At one time there were well over 250. And seven broad categories that are concentrated on by the board. Two of those sevens, the economy and education, have five indicators which the system is responsible for monitoring and does so. The purpose of having a progress board is to do strategic planning and try to align the vision of the state, your vision, with the institutions, the agencies, so that you have a common mission, values, strategy, measurements. And the challenge is always to measure what is valued by the people involved. And so it's a challenge because it continually changes. But the board has become more involved in the budgeting process. I think you've seen that as agencies have presented. The governor used the progress board, Jeff Tryons in particular, as he put together his budget. And so I think there's been a general trend in the last 2 years to try and make what the progress board does more relevant. And OUS has been responsive to that. In fact, there was an advancing government accountability contest, and the Oregon University System won. They won the famous Brownie Award, which includes not only brownie points but actual brownies, for having the annual performance report that did the best job in the view of Jeff Tryons and the Progress Board in reporting the data that they gathered, both on the internet and then in the performance review that was given. And why there's a brownie award is on any volunteer board I serve on, there's a requirement that there be chocolate. And so I'm responsible for that particular award. Also, the Oregon University System met 8 times with an informal group called the Ways and Means Working Group, chaired by Senator Schrader and co-chaired by Susan Morgan and Steve Bender, staffed that. During those 8 meetings, we covered 24 different subjects in detail, and a lot of that dealt with performance measures and what the legislature and the Ways and Means people in particular were looking for in the future. So Susan has been working with this, and we've tried to make adjustments and changes to be more responsive to what the working group indicated that were their wishes. And as I said, the challenge is the ability to adapt to the situation, not only the financial stresses and strains, but values of the state, the economy, how those things change. But the board is committed to doing that. And so with that, I'll stop and turn it over to Susan.
Thank you, Neil. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Susan Weeks, Deputy for Planning in the Chancellor's Office. Let me start out. I'm going to hold up some handouts. This is going to be a presentation that's a little bit PowerPoint light. We're not going to be going through so many slides and really going through more of the paper that you have in front of you. So let me show you what I'll be covering. The first one is a one-page graph that has 3 columns on it that looks like this, and it's called OUS Performance Measurement Alignment. The second is a thick set of pages called Summary of OUS 2003-2005 Performance Measures. And the third is the graph, which I know you have all seen because I've shared this with you as we've met in the past couple of weeks, OUS Performance and Accountability Framework. This is the piece I would like, for the moment I'm going to set it aside, but I want to keep this prominently in front of us because this is where I'm hoping we are aiming toward as we go through the measures that we have conventionally reported and continue to report. I'd like to keep in mind this framework as we move toward the future. I am very pleased to be able to share what we've been doing in performance measurement with you. As we look at this first handout, the OUS Performance Measurement Alignment, the columns, that gives you a sense of what the relationship is now, how we currently report our performance measures at several levels. We report not only to the Progress Board and to the state, our state level measures that are contributions to the Oregon benchmarks, but we also report to our Board of Higher Education, and we have a set of indicators that are mostly similar, not entirely the same as those that we report to the Progress Board. They're related but not identical. And as you can see, I try to depict in this graphic that in each case, they flow from a vision that is articulated in one way or another at the state level through Oregon Shines and at the board level through the Senate Bill 919 from 1997. And then those in turn flow to specific goals and measures or measurement areas identified at the state level through Oregon benchmarks and at the board level through the board's strategic initiatives of access, affordability, excellence, and economic development. And then from there are the set of specific indicators that are intended to support those goals and vision. as you can see, there are a very large number at the state level. The links to benchmarks currently for us number 31. At the board level, we have 13, five of which we ask institutions to set targets for. The others are reported with historical data and monitored. Now, as we move toward looking first at the links to benchmarks indicators, let me now reference the longer handout, which is the summary of OUS 2003-5 performance measures. And start by giving you just a few highlights. I will cover the measures, but I think in the interest of time, what I'll try to do, since we are running a little bit short of time, is to cover them as much as I can in the aggregate and focus and name the specific measures and where and highlight some key performance trends. And then I'm very happy to certainly respond to specific questions or to come back at a later time and focus in much greater specificity if that's your wish. I will also either now or at a later time respond to or discuss our request for some modifications, for some deletions and some additions to our set that we submit to the Progress Board. Let me start with just the highlights of where we have shown growth or improvement, where we've shown where we're holding steady and where we are falling short of target. On this slide, you'll see that these are the indicators reported to the Progress Board on which we do show improvement and growth. Student diversity, we have been improving, and we've tracked this on the report since 1999, and that the data for that are shown on page one of the report if you want to look at the specifics. Total undergraduate and graduate enrollment has been growing. Our freshman to sophomore year retention has been growing, not rapidly, but it has been growing and showing steady improvement. The number of community college transfers has been increasing. Our community college transfer graduation rate, the rate at which our transfers who come to us graduate, has been increasing. The Chancellor mentioned the bachelor's and advanced degrees awarded. That is probably the single best measure we have of our own productivity and of our own performance. This was the specific indicator which was the recipient of the Brownie Points Award that Neil mentioned, because it does provide a robust measure of lots of different aspects of our performance. As we look back, and we will, at what has happened since 1999 and what had happened before 1999, we can see that the improvement there appears certainly to be a direct result of the infusion of resources we had in the 1999 session that precipitated what I call a chain of very fortunate events that meant admitting larger numbers of students, providing resources to help them get through, to provide the courses that were needed, and ultimately, as you see 4 or 5 years later, much higher a number of degrees produced as a result. we also have seen increases in the engineering and computer science degrees awarded, in line with what the Engineering Technology Industry Council has set as a goal, and they are right on track for that. In the technology transfer area, the number of inventions disclosed and license income has shown improvement. And finally, as President Frohnmayer mentioned, that our sponsored research dollars have been increasing dramatically as well. These are the areas in which we've shown growth. Where we are holding steady are the six-year graduation rates for students entering as freshmen. They've shown some gradual improvement, but the last couple of years we are holding steady. We have not shown yet greater improvement, nor has it declined, but we are just at a steady state at this point. The satisfaction of bachelor's degree recipients, we do a survey biennially where we ask a lot of questions of our recent alumni about various aspects of their experience at their institution, and the overall satisfaction score has been consistently positive. It's been a 4.0 out of 5-point scale. And then the percent of graduates working in Oregon has remained steady, although, as you'll see in some of the other measures, the overall number who are employed following graduation has declined, as the economy has declined, the proportion working in Oregon has remained relatively constant. And then there are the indicators in which we are not meeting targets and what we call our warning signs. The number of first-time freshmen is one of the primary ones. Now, one of the things that we have on this new framework that is not part of the current set reported to the Progress Board is, I think, an important indicator to consider, and that is the freshman participation rate. The freshman participation rate is the proportion of students, of graduates of the most recent high school graduating class who enter our institutions the following fall as freshmen. And that rate had been increasing, and in particular, following the additional resources in the 1999 session, we saw that increase to, I think, about the highest or close to the highest level we had had. With subsequent budget declines and over the ensuing 3 or 4 years, we've seen a decline the last 2 years in that freshman participation rate. That is reflected in our report to the Progress Board in the number of freshmen, although we do not yet report the participation rate. That is likely to be an indicator we would like to report in the future. The ratio of students to full-time faculty is clearly a warning sign. I think you've heard this in previous testimony, that as we track the proportion of full-time faculty or the proportion of students to full-time faculty, we've seen some dramatic increases, which is not a good thing, because we already had a fairly high student-faculty ratio relative to our peer institutions. And for almost all of our institutions right now, that students to full-time faculty ratio is the highest of all of their peers.
Let me ask a question here also. In the three categories that we've looked at thus far, including the warning signs, not meeting targets, where does faculty diversity fit as a performance measure? It appears to be missing as a performance measure. And if that's the case, I would encourage that it needs to be added. But could you talk about where we are with faculty diversity in terms of warning sign, not meeting targets, and the other two categories that we just visited?
Yes, indeed. Senator Gordley, you are correct. It is not a performance measure at this time, and I think as you and I have also discussed, that we have added some other measures that we think are very important in our set on student diversity. We have not yet done that on faculty diversity, and I think that's a good point. That is not in our set right now.
I think faculty diversity goes to the issue of quality, overall quality. And so, again, I strongly encourage that performance measure be developed for phase two.
Okay. Thank you. Point well taken. The student faculty ratio really needs to be accompanied by a trend line showing the proportion of faculty who are part-time. That is not part of our reported set of data to the Progress Board, but it is, again, in the new framework that we are proposing, because they go together. As campuses have tried to accommodate the demand from students in the best way they can under conditions of worsening resources, they have done so by supplementing what they cannot provide by full-time faculty with part-time faculty and adjuncts. And so we try to monitor that as to see what, have a good sense of whether there are measures and outcomes there that we need to be aware of as a potential early warning sign of erosion of student experience. And then finally, with regard to the statewide public services, we have a measure that is the external funds generated per state dollar invested in the past 2 years. That has dropped very likely a result of the decline in their budgets as well. Let me now turn to the specific report, and I'll reference pages as I go along. And again, I will I think, do this in a little bit more abbreviated fashion than I might otherwise do, and so that there is time to respond to your specific questions on any of the indicators.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question for, Mr. Bender. Are we tying our performance measures to the Oregon benchmarks? In other committees, I've been led to believe that, well, that's the Oregon benchmarks are kind of there, but we're not kind of looking. We're kind of looking at them. What, from the committee member standpoint, how, or from your, how do you view this?
Senator and committee members, my understanding is that the committee is to look over the benchmarks that have been proposed by the agency and to suggest any changes, additions, or deletions that you feel are appropriate, and that eventually, as part of the adoption of the budget, you will include an adoption of performance measures that you are directing the agency to measure and to continue to bring that information to the legislature until or unless you change that direction. So in that sense, there is no specific expectation that you necessarily relate them to specific benchmarks or not. It's just what you believe is important in measures of the agencies that you are funding.
Hold up, Mr. Chair. I think there's at least some agreement with this committee that the circle of prosperity as defined by Oregon Shines or Oregon Progress Board is broken, because we are not able to provide sufficient funding for the various services that are being asked for. So, I mean, my conflict here, my difficulty is, I'm supposed to be performance measuring these things to benchmarks, and the benchmarks are benchmarked to a thing that is broken. What good am I doing here as far as looking at these things? I mean, I think we need to, if that's what I'm doing, we ought to start all over again and say, okay, how did we get to the point where we provide this revenue that's being asked of us? I mean, that's kind of more of a global thing. But I'm just sort of expressing some concerns from my viewpoint here.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Sen. Nelson, the Oregon benchmarks take a view probably from about the 25,000 foot elevation level, but they are significant and they're reflected in what Susan's talking about. For example, one of them is some college completion, and another is college completion of a bachelor's degree or associate degree. So I think it's still significant, even though there's been a funding crisis, because it lets you know what the impact of that is. And then you, what happens with the other indicators that Susan has, you bore down into it and find out what the other criteria are, the other indicators of what's affecting it more specifically. But the benchmarks are at that higher level.
Just to follow on, I'm thinking the underlying problem is we're not able to significantly fund programs we need to do the things we need to do. So, wonderful to have these benchmarks, but we know that if you had more money, you could do a better job. That's pretty straightforward. We're not able to provide you the money, so how do we get to the point, whether it's tax reform or my position using natural resources? See, I think that Oregon university system has that obligation to come up with a study of saying, why do some states have surpluses and some states don't? I'm going through a nice exercise here, but sometimes, and I'm hearing this from other members of Ways and Means, not on this committee, but other things. Why are we going through this exercise if we're not really tying them to performance measures? We are, but we aren't. And so I'm a little confused at this point, I guess, and where we're supposed to go with all this.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Well, I would just offer that the Oregon benchmarks set forth a vision, and we, in my view, always want to hold out our vision, whatever it is, and it's very clearly defined in the Oregon benchmarks document, that is our vision. And understanding that we are falling far short of our vision because of the lack of revenue to make key investments in any number of categories, but we want to hold out the vision. We want to keep it there. I don't know how to say it more clearly. I would not want to see us dismantle the vision and just walk away from it and as though the Oregon benchmarks no longer have any value or any meaning. I wouldn't want to see us do that. I think we're struggling right now around this whole piece of how do we fund the vision and how do we convince Oregonians to fund the vision, let alone how do we convince 90 legislators to sign on to and fund the vision. A people without vision perish, someone said. So we have to have a vision.
Senator Gourley and Senator Nelson, I understand both of your views, and I don't think that they're dissimilar from one another. I think part of, if I could, I can't speak for Senator Nelson, obviously, but I think part of the frustration in performance measures is that if we have a discussion on performance measures, and many times that discussion will be what our anticipated improvements are in those measures. There is some reality check here that, at least in a few areas, where we should actually be having a discussion saying, given the resources that we have available, we're going to think that you are doing well if you don't decline any farther than this point on this performance measure. Because if we can't provide the resources to actually fulfill that performance measure, then very clearly maybe we should not anticipate a huge improvement in that particular area. I think that's the difficulty that Senator Nelson is at least alluding to in part.
Mr. Chair, one of the purposes of the progress report is also to be realistic. So as we gather that data, if it's clear that we need to change what the goal is for whatever the reason, then the progress board asks the agency to take a look at that, and we may adopt a different goal and modify that vision just to reflect what the realities are.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Gourley and Senator Nelson, this conversation is very very relevant to the concerns we've been facing as we've tried to set targets of understanding what kinds of how much reality do we deal with versus how aspirational do we be. And in our setting of the targets here, we've probably tended more toward the aspirational. We've tried to set we want to set the bar high enough so that we have goals to aim for. But I appreciate very much your comments that we also need to keep in mind what the realities of our situation are and what the expectations might be given different levels of funding to achieve these outcomes. If I may, I'll proceed to this document. And I think at this point, let me just cover the first two pages and then beg your indulgence to perhaps return to this at some later time to look at the detail or to just simply leave that in your hands to review. The first two pages summarize all of the 31 indicators. But in this case, I have grouped them according to our board's and the governor's strategic initiatives of access, affordability, excellence, and economic development. And so when you look down the sequence of numbering on the left, they don't go in sequence because these have been rearranged. And the access measures that we are looking at right now in the set reported to the Progress Board are the number and percent of students who are students of color, the number of entering first-time freshmen, the number of students who are new Oregon Community College transfers, the number of undergraduates enrolled, the number of advanced degree students enrolled in credit courses. And we also are currently reporting on the measuring up, the national report card, letter grade awarded to Oregon on participation, which we have a request to delete because it's kind of a moving target and the methodology changes with each report and it's more a measure of statewide effort as opposed to OUS effort. Under affordability, we have added indicators for the first time in the 03-05 biennium. And this was, as Senator Gordley will recall, a result of conversation we had in a budget note we had regarding tracking affordability. And so we initially developed two measures, one of which we are now asking to delete because we realize that setting a target for the percent of undergraduates receiving Pell Grants is a bit problematic because we don't know what's good. Is it good to have more? Is it good to have fewer? There are other issues of how robust that measure is, and so we are proposing to maintain the other one that we did present, the percent of total cost of attendance at OUS covered by state and federal need-based aid for resident undergraduate financial aid recipients. We would like to make that even stronger by being able to look at both financial aid including loans and financial aid excluding loans, because we know that loan debt is an issue, and we want to be able to track the issue of loans a little bit more closely. And we are proposing a new one on the cost of attendance for a resident undergraduate as a percent of Oregon median family income. This starts to get at some other national comparators and I think gives us a measure of cost in relation to family income in Oregon. The array of measures under excellence is quite varied. We include in this set, student progress, graduation rates, persistence rates, the student faculty ratio, the graduate satisfaction rating. We also include the graduate success, that is the proportion of our graduates who are either employed or in graduate school 1 year following graduation. And some of the data, as President Dow mentioned in her presentation, is also tracked more closely and with more detail at the campuses. We also include under excellence the sponsored research and philanthropy, which currently is defined as foundation net assets. We will very likely bring back to the progress board in our next report a request to add a bit to that to pull from that, in addition to foundation net assets, have just gifts, and so we can have a more robust measure there. On page 2, continuing on, we have a list of measures that we grouped under the category of economic development, including the bachelor's and advanced degrees awarded, degrees awarded in engineering, computer science. We also have a measure for employer satisfaction with regard to an engineering computer science graduates. The percent of our graduates completing an internship, the technology transfer measures, number of inventions. Currently in the set are U.S. number of U.S. patent applications and patents granted per year, both of which we are requesting to delete because those are actually more process measures, not outcome measures. We want to focus very much on outcomes, and patents are simply one of several ways to achieve an outcome, not necessarily the best measure, and is more of a process measure. So we are focusing on the number of inventions disclosed per year and the license income per $100 million of research per year as better outcome measures to retain, and also the number of startup and spin-off companies per year. And I do want to mention that as you review the data on that, while we like the measure, we don't like the data source that we have been using. It is a national data source. It's from the Association of University Technology Managers. It has a very restricted definition of startup and spin-off companies. And, for example, I know the number that President Frohnmayer just gave you in his presentation does not square at all. His is a better measure than what we are seeing in the national data source, and so we do want to retain that measure. We simply want to find a better source of data, and if we need to, we'll work with our campuses to develop that specifically for Oregon.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
I know that this category is targeting economic development, and I understand that we would want to have a measure for the total number of degrees granted in engineering and computer science. But I'm wondering about some other professional categories where we also have severe shortages. Nursing, math teachers, teachers of foreign languages. Your thoughts, please, on how and where we would include measures that would tell us that would track our progress in those areas of deficiency.
I would be very happy to, Senator Gordley. Let me then refer you to this graphic, which is our framework that we are proposing, because that does get at that. When we and perhaps I might just jump straight to that right now, if I may, because I think this captures in a more holistic sense what we are trying to do in aligning what we report to our board, what we have targeted as critical indicators in the course, especially over the past year with the board's working groups and in addressing specific initiatives, and how we can align that with the 31 indicators that we currently report to the progress board. This represents that alignment and that effort. And in the course of doing that, we identified where there were gaps in the constellation of indicators, and we have added even more. And I normally approach these things as trying to find a way to reduce and make it and to simplify, but as we have done this, we've been faced with the problem of both simplifying and making more complex. And so somehow I find myself in the odd position of having apparently done both of those things in this graph. And let me explain what this is. And I did, I think, explain this to you when I met with each of you. But to review, the gray boxes represent what we consider our primary and secondary outcome measures for each of the areas of affordable access, student progress, education quality, and the economic and civic contributions. These areas then each have within under each of the primary and secondary measures. So, for example, under affordable access, the primary measure is the cost covered by federal and state financial aid. A secondary measure of affordable access would be the freshman participation rate, which I mentioned earlier. And then below that is an array of supporting indicators that are important and certainly needed there to provide a rigorous understanding of performance in the area of affordable access, but would not be the primary ones we would focus on if we needed to focus on a smaller set that is a little bit more manageable to deal with. Likewise, under student progress, graduation rate as the primary indicator with the freshman to sophomore persistence rate as a secondary and the ones you see there below that. When we get over to the right-hand side, and Senator Gordley, in response directly to your question, under economic and civic contributions, and I should say also although we do focus very much on economic development, we do not want to overlook the importance of civic contributions as well. And so these measures include both civic and economic development indicators. The primary indicator of bachelor's and advanced degrees is there. The degrees and shortage areas would include not only the engineering computer science, but teacher education and the health professions. We have proposed adding those as additional areas to track in terms of degrees.
Oh, you have proposed adding that?
Yes.
Okay.
And we are proposing that in that. It doesn't, because of the limits of space on the graph, you don't see those there, but those are... They are not yet in that set, which is the report to the progress board. But if once we secure all the right kinds of approvals and messages to go forward with this, this is where we would like to go, and we would like to include those shortage areas in our set of secondary indicators that we would be tracking. Likewise, underneath the... that area, the supporting indicators include some new ones. And as you look at this graph, the indicators in italic are those that are not yet part of either what we report to our board or what is reported to the progress board. but they're indicators that either need to be developed or they are reported in other kinds of publications and reports that we routinely do but have not yet entered the array of performance measures, and we would propose that they now be included. And so some of these, for example, under affordable access, the 25 to 49-year-olds enrolled part-time. We have the data. We can report this. We have not yet made that a performance measure, but we would like to. We think it's one important aspect. Similarly, under student progress, the graduation rate for students of color, the time to degree for freshmen, community college transfers, and students of color has not yet been a part of our array of performance measures. We think it's very important to include. We have the data, we can include it, and we propose to do that. This is part of the framework we have developed. It's not yet part of what is reported to the Progress Board, but we would like to work with the Progress Board in arraying and realigning our measures along this framework.
Ms. Weeks, we are very close to the end of our meeting today. I anticipate you will be back tomorrow, obviously. So if you would like to just close in the next minute for today, and if the Chancellor has anything that you want to say at this point.
The only thing, and I appreciate your indulgence on the time so far, the only thing I do want to say is that we are very committed to continuously improving how we approach performance measurement. We want this to be meaningful. We want it to be rigorous. And we seek your help and guidance in making that happen.
Mr. Bender had one comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment and just clarify that this whole review of performance measures, I hope that the subcommittee would view this as a tool for you to help fulfill your fiduciary responsibilities. And in that sense, this is an opportunity for you to direct all the agencies before you on what measures of performance you are interested in getting back to get a better understanding of how well they're doing with the funds that you've provided them. So I understand the comments about requesting the Progress Board to approve this, but higher ed has lots of information well beyond what these performance measures are. And their board is asking for some things, and the Progress Board might be interested in other things. But this is what you're interested in here, and that's why this process will be that you will end up eventually providing a list for them of performance measures and perhaps instructions about what the targets for these measures should look like, that it will be useful to you.
I really, Mr. Chair, yes. I appreciate Mr. Bender's emphasis, and so I want to just underscore again my interest and concern that we hone in on the math teachers, the teachers of foreign language, the special ed teachers, the nurses, and again, those areas of shortage that we know we have, and listing those in terms of developing key performance measures around those shortage areas. Does that make sense to you? Because I'm.
It does, and I will need. We have been working very closely, Senator Gordley, with our Provost Council, and I will seek their advice on how to respond to that in the best way that we can.
I also had one additional request too. In the answer to the questions from the letter dated March 10th about the percent of Oregon high school graduates who apply to OUS campus for admission are admitted. There is. Can I get a clarification on that, whether admitted means that they did enroll or merely that they were admitted? And also on your standard for access, it says number of entering first-time freshmen, and it uses the words, do qualified Oregonians have access to public higher education, and using that as a measurement. Have you previously broken that down into resident and non-resident freshmen, and is it possible to do that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, On your first question concerning the admitted, those are the students who have applied for admission, have been admitted to the institution, but may or may not have enrolled. Generally, if that percentage, which I recall from the data that you have in hand, is about 88% who have been admitted, about 50% of the applicants actually enroll.
Which I think is relatively normal because
yes.
students apply to multiple
Absolutely.
Universities.
That's right.
Yeah.
And in response to your second question, yes, we do track both the resident and non-resident freshman enrollment and freshman participation rate.
I'm fine with non-residents paying the full cost and attending, but I think it might be helpful to the committee to know what the resident numbers are also. Because one of the figures that we have heard before is, I can't remember the exact number, but it's something like about only 15% of our high school students end up entering or graduating with a associate or bachelor's degree, at least for our current graduates.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Devlin, we would be happy to bring back the information on that question.
Yeah. Thank you. We will close for now if there are no additional questions, and we will start again promptly at 8:30 tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.